When a youthful Herb Alpertz and the Tijuana Brass opened for a curmudgeonly Arnold Schoenberg and the Pastels at the Las Vegas Hilton Copacabana Room on the 6th of December 1951, it was indeed poignant to see the baton of pointillistic rhythm and blues pass from one generation to another. For while Arnold could still blow a mean atonal melody on his Honer Marine Band, it was clear that, at 77, his riffs were slowing down. He had been touring for a dozen years with Joe Stafford and Paul Weston, playing the idiot son in Jonathan and Darlene Edwards' musical reviews. His comic timing was superb, and the way he could make his eyeballs seem to pop out of their sockets always brought down the house. But he really shone during the big band finale when he'd jam with the real musicians. No jokes, no sight gags, just good, hard, existential rhythm and blues. The chromatic improvisations he blew still gave the paying clientele lots of goosebumps. There was no doubt about it. But serial purists began to notice little flaws in the structure of his retrograde inversions. Sometimes Arnie would find a groove he liked, and he'd just vamp on it, and to hell with 12-tone order, or, as he put it, zu Hölle mit dem Zwölfklanger Ordnung.
Zu Hölle mit dem Zwölfklanger Ordnung.
He said that.
I said it. Zu Hölle.
But when one night he found himself trading 4-bar, 3-blind mice licks for the tenor sax, he realized that blind mice licks. What happened to the tune? Oh, I see, it's just changed.
It's become pointillistic, as the baton was passed.
Pointillistic monontropo.
You want more tropo?
Now this is tropo enough. So there he was, trading 4-bar, 3-blind mice licks. Mice licks. Yeah, mice licks. I do like that. With the tenor sax, he realized that he'd finally exhausted his musical vocabulary. So he quit the Jonathan and Darlene review and moved to Paris, where he taught master classes at Nadia Boulanger's École Gymnastique.
The École Gymnastique, it was a wonderful place. I remember trying to get those 12 tones over the high bars.
He had help. He had teaching assistants, too.
And he could say, Zuhille!
Yes. One of his students, a gangly, giraffe-necked Dave Brubeck, had just split with his own post-war, pre-industrial jazz band called The Pastels. Arnold took an immediate liking to their performance costumes, which were loud and brassy in color, and smelled vaguely of fish.
Ah, le flambeau pastel.
Not yet, but...
I know it is. Oh, not yet? I will go smell some fish then.
He encouraged them to continue playing, and offered to sit in on their practice sessions. Without the Brubeckian influence, the Pastels sounded subdued, colorless, so Arnold taught them, Der Zwölfklanger Wehklagen, or the 12-tone whale. No, whale is in cetacean, big floppy.
Oh, the big critters. Oh, they go.
That's it. Some cats can play the whale, and some can't. The Pastels not only played it, but they cooked their axes, sounding as if they invented it. Revitalized, Arnold blew off the remaining 3 months on his teaching contract and returned to America, Los Angeles, taking the Pastels with him. Fronting the band at dinner theater gigs and cartoon soundtrack recording sessions, he began to make a name for himself in the pre-modernist L.A. subculture. Atonal rifts flew from his horn like angry shrikes from a toxic sycamore. He was in top pointillistic form once again. Word of his newly incisored chops filtered to Las Vegas, and he was soon signed to play the infamous Copacabana Room at the Hilton, where, 40 years before, Igor Stravinsky had floored a normally sedate gambling crowd with his six-part a cappella arrangement of Le Flambeau du Printemps.
Le Flambeau du Printemps.
Precipitating a minor tsunami at the concession stand. The day arrived, blue-black and insolent. Arnold was ready. The pastels were ready. The audience was huge and expectant. First, though, there was the matter of the opening act. Herb Alpert, a French trumpeter who reputedly could make a kazoo weep. Could he ever? By the end of his first set, in which he seemingly serialized every known meatball melody, then artfully inverted their harmonic structures, the audience, the pastels, even old Arnold sat stunned, unable to exhale. And as his concluding set was messing with Mr. Mahler, turning his Totenlieder to toast with spicy south-of-the-border canonic variations, Schoenberg realized that there was no reason for him to ever play another note. This Alpert cat could do it all. The audience agreed and thundered its approval, during which time Arnold skulked away into the night, never to be seen again. The next day, in an op-ed piece, the LA Times revealed that Schoenberg had really been dead since July and asked any eyewitnesses to his recent performances to explain what they thought they saw. No one could, of course. As can no one really explain the passing of the music baton from week to week on Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, this 133rd episode of which is equally startled to open with an atonalistic rhythm and blues baton passing from Calvos.
Yes.
Or to Calvos. I'm not sure which way the baton is going.
The baton is going somewhere. I think it is slowly fading away.
Well, you have been
speaking over the music of Joseph Koikar and Joseph Koikar's piece Continuum from 1982, that on a compact disc called Expressed in Units.
Unix?
Unix. Expressed in Unix.
Why, how lovely.
And at the moment, I was hoping that by the time you got done with your essay, we could be hooked up to the Austrian radio, which is a coming over live on the internet with their celebration of 25 years of radio art.
That's us. We're part of the not the mainstream, I guess the sub-menu stream of postmodernist avant art. So just wail away. I guess you could have a little more tune by this other guy.
Well, maybe not. What other guy? There's nothing. Should we do some more Koikar just a little bit?
See if there's anything worth talking over.
All right. Well, we'll do a little bit more Joseph Koikar, and then we'll be back with the Austrian radio if we're lucky.
Thank you.
Music by Joseph Koikar.
Part one of a three-point perspective, written in 1986.
Well, you know, I got that and a couple other CDs in the mail the other day, and I was really curious about them because one guy by the name of Christopher De Laurenti said in his notes on the back of the CD, he said,
"Adventurous new music made with traditional and homemade instruments that sound like nothing you've ever heard before."
I'm doing the accent.
Are you?
Yeah. I'm not sure that he actually is responsible for the accent. But and then he said
that the tune leads you to believe that it may be his accent. Is this it?
Still live from Austria.
That was great. That was just wonderful.
There's network congestion, apparently.
Oh.
So,
The voice of the future, the sound sculptures of radio. That's incredible. I don't think you want to do more. Too much of a good thing, you know. Gets. Listen, melody, harmony, counterpoints. And those silences are pithy.
Well, what can I tell you? I thought we'd have a good connection, I guess, because it is Saturday night in Austria. The network must be congested over there, so we're...
Who needs an interview when we can play with this?
And the network has stopped again. So much for technological prowess on the Calvis and Damien New Music Bazaar.
Now, don't degrade it any more than it deserves.
Well, we'll just let that noodle in the background, because as Christopher De Laurenti continues here,
no new age noodling, droning drum machines, ambient fog, or other demeaning crap.
Right,
he said that.
Loud, weird, disturbing, no compromises.
And he particularly points us to a piece called Cannon Sludge as an example of this lack of compromises and this emptiness of ambient fog, no demeaningness, and certainly whatever other powerful thing. So would you like to hear this?
Absolutely. My appetite is severely whetted.
I'm sure it is. Well, here it comes. Music by Christopher De Laurenti. Not demeaning, no ambient fog, droning dumb machines, yes, or new age noodling.
Thank you.
controversial, eh?
Boy, I'll say it.
Yes, sir.
Explain it. What does he say about this tune?
He says nothing really about the tune. He just... And there's more. There's part of Three Camels for Orchestra. There you have it.
We've
no
heard
compromises.
This before.
Yes, I'm sure we have. We'll have a discussion, I think, with Christopher De Laurenti about this at some point. Will be worth
good,
it.
Good, good.
So I thought, well, what other tunes were compromise-free? So I brought in a bunch of things that might be considered compromise-free. Here's a little Marc Batier compromise-free music. This is Cybernauts Flight. Okay, Cybernauts Flight, little piece. That's compromise-free.
Yeah, that works.
There's no new age ambience, no dumb machines.
It depends on how close you listen.
I see. You think we have Austria yet?
There it is. There it is. Austria calling. Can't get enough of it.
Network's still congested over there. Maybe later in the show we'll have a little bit.
Again, compromise-free.
All right, let's go back to the compromise-free. Here's music by Nick Dudkowsky, a little piece called Fly Killer. Let's work on that one for a while. Chew on Fly Killer. Thank you. That was Fly Killer by Nick Ditkovsky. The background. I didn't explain myself very well about what this is, did I?
Not as such.
I see. This Austrian radio was one of the pioneers of radio art.
Yeah, I think this was explained in an essay about a year ago.
Perhaps, yes, radio art, right. And they are celebrating 25 years of radio art by hooking up across Europe with Helsinki, Milan, Paris, Amsterdam, and a few other major radio stations, and doing collaborative performances and a five-day non-stop set of broadcasts across the continent of radio art. At the same time, they are also broadcasting the entire set of performances live on the internet with three feeds from Graz, Linz, and Vienna. And there was supposed to have been one from Salzburg also, but I don't see it on the website. Right now, because it is in Central European time, it is about 9 p.m., it is probably the top congestion level right now in Central Europe. So we're having a hard time getting through to the webcast of this, but there is some coming through, and if we can hang on to it when it comes back from network congestion, we'll listen to a little bit of it before going to Carl Stone and then our interview with David Behrman.
Also, I think we can look forward in the near future to have CD releases of all of these pieces.
That would be nice. Oh, we're congested again. Give them some Robitussin for the radio. Radiotussin. We'll give them one more shot here. Maybe we can get them back on. We're caught in the web. Caught in the web.
I don't hear much of Finland in there. It seems to all be Salzburg.
It must be all the old days of shortwave. It's like trying to tune in shortwave across the ocean. All right, well, for at least this half hour, we're going to give up on our connection to Graz and the Austrian radio celebration, and we're going to go to listen to a little bit of Carl Stone before the hour.
No compromises.
No compromises. Music by Carl Stone. That from his new release called 1196 or 1196. That was otherwise known as Niala First Section.
Yep. You can hear it in the compromise-freeness of the music that it is the first section.
You know, he's so energetic in some of the other pieces that he's done, and this is very, very uncompromisingly, oh, we are bad, uncompromisingly linear. No new age, no dumb machines, none of that stuff. No, what was the other word he said? Well, never mind. It's the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar here on an Austria-free afternoon. And we are about to go to our interview with David Behrman on...
Oh, good. I was waiting.
WGDR, Plainfield. We'll pick it up with Figure in a Clearing, music that we were listening to 5 weeks ago. Yeah, alas. And then we'll go into the interview in about 5 minutes. This is the conclusion of Figure in a Clearing. Thank you.
Gosh, music by David Behrman, who's just jumped up from the microphone again and is heading for the water tap, the dripping faucet. As we were off mic there for a moment, I had to ask you if I remembered correctly that you, in fact, did this piece in 1977 at a concert that I produced in New Jersey at the New Jersey State Museum.
That's just amazing.
And I remember it being a wonderful piece at the time, and I remember being very impressed with the absolute lushness of the sound coming out of this tiny computer along with the cello.
Isn't that amazing?
It was a beautiful, beautiful piece at the time, and it still is a beautiful piece. It's wonderful.
It's interesting because those early, they were homemade synthesizers, mm-hmm. and it became impractical at some point to keep using them. It's one of the real problems of working in electronic arts is how to keep things current, because everything changes. It's very hard to use a 14-year-old computer. It's almost impossible. It is impossible, I think, because you have to keep all this information about details in your head.
And yes.
You just can't do it. And then the hardware, those homemade synthesizers, had qualities that you can't get from commercial synthesizers. But there's every reason in the world to use commercial synthesizers now and not the homemade ones. For a lot of reasons. The homemade things are inflexible. They only do one thing.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to break down. They tend to depend on parts you can't even buy anymore. And the circuit boards corrode, and the connectors corrode, and they're big and heavy.
Yeah. Yes.
And there's, so it's really difficult. I mean, if you were very well funded and you had specialists working on this issue, you could probably do it. This has come into the minds of a lot of people dealing with David Tudor's work, because, as you must know, he just died last summer.
Yes.
And he left behind an amazing, I mean, his work is totally unique and totally amazing. But reviving it is very, very difficult, except through recordings. And he left hundreds of homemade devices. And even the people who worked with him are mystified about a lot of the stuff, how it works, what it does. And even to find out whether it's working or not is a problem. In his case, I've really been thinking about this a lot, because as we're doing our work with electronic arts, the decades are going by. Everything is changing a million times a year.
Yeah.
And I find it almost impossible to have a repertory that goes back into the past. It's as though the only thing that can exist is the latest thing that you have on the top of your brain now. And
do you attempt to emulate any of the earlier pieces with contemporary software and hardware?
Yeah, I do. And for instance, last summer, Kosugi and I did a concert together at the Lincoln Center Summer Festival, and they asked us to do this piece that we developed together in the 80s. And the first version had homemade synthesizers and Apple II software,
mm-hmm.
and also some other things. And I thought, well, I'll get this running in 1996. And it took me about three times longer than I thought it would. But I did succeed in doing it, but it took me like 3 months to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The old software was much simpler than what I'm doing now, but to get in, to remember how it worked, and then somehow you don't just put those old fourth words in the new computer. Somehow you have a new way of doing it, and then you have to start thinking again. And it just took a long time, and the result is different. It's not the same as the original piece, because the hardware is different. Some of the hardware is different.
Is it satisfactory to redo it, or do you get dissatisfied with it and say, I really don't want to do this old stuff, I want to move on?
Well, yeah, there's some questioning of that, yeah. But, I mean, I was glad to be able to bring this one up again. I'd like to be able to do those old pieces, like that figure in a clearing. If I put it on commercial synthesizers, even ones where you can affect the tuning.
Mm-hmm.
I think I actually could do it very close, because I could get an Ultra Proteus that has triangle wave. You can get a triangle wave, and you can adjust the tuning.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to be exactly the same because some of those old things wavered a little bit in pitch.
Right. And you temperature affected
yeah,
things.
Temperature and, yeah, temperature, and you got these beats, and a lot of oscillators tuned to the same frequencies, but they were drifting apart a little bit. And you got all these things that is you can't get now, really. Or you can, but with great difficulty.
It would almost be that you'd have to take the contemporary digital equipment and write a routine to emulate the accidental random detuning of the,
that's
the
right.
original.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
It's very nice a concept.
And then imagine 20 years from now to bring back today's electronic art.
Right. What is it? What is going on today? I mean, what?
Well,
what is
I'm actually out of date. I feel like I'm sort of old-fashioned now because it's just rushing ahead so fast. I feel that for me, I mean, of course, I'm trying to learn new things and. But for me, it's sort of 1990, 1991, that's sort of where I mean, one has to stop somewhere and work. Otherwise, you spend all your time learning new techniques all the time. There's no time to do the work.
Well, we had an interview with Eliane Radigue, and she was working with, what was she using, the ARP?
The ARP 2600.
Yeah, and she had done some wonderful work with that in the early days.
Yeah, really wonderful.
And she is now reworking some of those other, some of those early pieces with digital.
Right, actually.
And she says, it is so hard to start over again.
I know, yeah. Actually, I was involved in that because Leticia Sonami and I kind of together decided that we should arrange for her to use, we decided on an Ultra Proteus. Leticia got it for her, we were talking about it. And we both feel we need to help her. She's in Paris. And I want to help her with it, and because it's, she just needs to be able to use it the way she likes.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would seem that a piece of equipment, contemporaneous equipment, should be able to accommodate the user instead of the other way around. But
right.
It's not always the case.
It's not always the case. Yeah. So I've been thinking about that. What could Elion use in terms of auxiliary equipment that would help her? And it's related to these other problems that we all have. Yeah.
So there's we talked about some of your early stuff, and then we talked about some of the recent. Well, bridge us from the mid-70s, late-70s to the present. What were you doing in those interim years? What interesting things were happening?
After the Kim One days, do you know Martin Bartlett?
No, I don't know.
He was a wonderful composer. He lived in Vancouver, and he was the one who started us on fourth. He came down to the Bay Area. At least he started me on fourth, the fourth language, which was the one that I learned for music. And I happened to be there when fourth seemed to be very convenient. I've tried other languages, and I haven't been able to learn them, or I just haven't liked them. And so along around then, the end of the 70s and early 80s, I started doing music in that language, fourth. And I'm still really working that way, except now for the last 6 years I've worked with Formula, which...
Yes, you said it was a...
Yeah.
Cousin.
Right. There have just been different pieces since the late 70s that all have to do with software.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them had to do with pitch sensing.
And that means what? That means that there's a live performer who's playing and this has some relationship to that?
Yeah, one or more live performers playing and not being told what to do, but just using this system as though it were an audio game-like situation. One could
an improviser.
Sometimes, yeah, improvisers. I actually that word is I try not to use that word too much somehow because it has a lot of contexts that I don't know. But yes, if one says there's either written music or there's improvisation, then it's closer to improvisation. But sometimes the software moves from one situation to another. So the software could be compositional, but without being fixed. Mm-hmm. Performers are not told what to do. Mm-hmm. But they might have to deal with several programs, each of which is quite different or somewhat different. Some might respond to specific pitches, others might respond to volume changes, mm-hmm. or non-pitch sounds, or waving of buccal wands, or something that's not necessarily musical, but always, I mean, for myself, I've just been always working with interaction of one sort or another.
I could see this working into the next generation of karaoke. I don't know if you've considered it, but...
You could think of a soloist, and then there's a automated orchestra.
Yes.
And there you are. Yeah.
We're talking about fourth and formula as languages. Actually, in a sense, you've got to program. You really have to
program
line
yeah.
at a time. You
right.
write you
right.
write words and commands.
Right.
There's another sort of movement in creating computer algorithms, which involves one of the best examples is Max, which
right.
is a graphical
right.
Interface. Do mm-hmm. you have any opinions on the differences, differences of feel, or whether you think that's a good direction to go?
I'm sure that if I were starting out now, I would start with Max and not with Forth. I mean, a lot of my friends use Max. A lot of the composer friends that I have use
Max. Is it as flexible? Does it have a bias or point of view different from, say, programming a line at the time?
I haven't used it in detail. I've played with it a little bit, but I've never made a piece with it. But some people I know who have worked in both have more of it, could speak at greater length
okay.
with the differences.
Right.
Prince George Lewis has worked with mm-hmm. both. He likes formula. He uses formula. And he also knows Max, and he teaches it at UCSD to his students. And David Wessel, of course, developed it at IRCOM with other people.
Right.
And teaches it at Berkeley to his students. And it's a much easier way into interactive music than the way I work is.
Mm-hmm.
But some people who work with both will tell you that Max can get kind of clogged up when it gets complicated.
I see. Uh-huh.
And at first it's very wonderful, and then as you get more and more complicated, it starts slowing down and gets difficult. Now, I can't say that at first hand because I've never followed that through. I've never made a complicated piece in Max and compared it with a complicated piece in Forth. So I don't know it firsthand. And as the computers get faster and faster, probably that will be less and less of a problem.
Sure of a problem yeah.
And I'd like to use it because I'm sure it would be a lot of fun. But I just haven't yet because I'm always working on something the other
yeah.
way.
Yeah. Well, you said that you use MIDI stuff now.
Yeah.
That tends to get clogged up, though, too, doesn't it?
For me, not so much, because I don't do tremendously dense, tremendously fast things.
I see.
I mean, I just have never had, like, 64 channels going very fast. George has talked about that, George Lewis, that, you know, he tends to push those envelopes, maximum density and speed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for me, I just haven't really run up against that, although I'd like a faster computer.
We always want it.
Right. Yeah. Are we off? Oh, sorry.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. You think this is too technical?
Not for us.
Okay.
So we've heard chunks of stuff from '70s, from the '80s, and you're going to bring us up to the turn of the past decade now.
There's this piece called Unforeseen Events. which was from around 90. And it's an interactive piece, and working with Ben Neal, who plays mutant trumpet, which is a trumpet with which he's developed himself that has several bells.
Is this mute and ampersand trumpet, or M-U-T-A-N-T?
Yeah, M-U-T-A-N-T. Mutant trumpet with only one T, I guess. Mutant trumpet.
Oh, it's one word. Oh, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah.
I think we actually have heard that in something.
I'm sure you've heard it in other things. I mean, he's a composer, performer, and yeah. He's done a lot of things with it on his own, developed it himself. But we worked together a lot for several years. And so this piece from around 90 it's a set of programs that are like different sections, and each one is based on nine sets of nine pitches, which do things when he hits them. And so the idea is similar to the 1984 idea, but it's in character, it's a little different. It goes from very slow to very fast, maybe in a different way.
Let's hear it. Unforeseen events, David Behrman.
How does an audience, particularly a younger audience, brought up on the era of smoother, new agier, post-minimalist, tonal, crossover, I'm listing them all, music, how do they begin to listen to this? If they've not come through the history of this kind of interactive work with computers and such, how do they approach it? How does a new listener, even if it's not a young listener, a new listener come to your music and sense what it is?
I guess you should ask them. I mean, I'm not. It's so remote from my own experience. I wish I could erase my brain cells and have that experience myself, and then I would probably learn something.
Because we have our listening audience is general,
yeah.
And they're going to say, in these few musical excerpts they've been able to hear today, well, maybe we don't get it.
Uh-huh.
What is it that you, as a composer, hope they'll get?
Well, I always think that if it's fun for the performing musicians, if they're enjoying it, then that's a sign that people who aren't performing will enjoy it too. Mm-hmm.
But that was said for years about some of the more obscure and complicated sides of jazz, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That during the years when the sort of general listening public ran away from jazz because they said, we don't get it. And often it was said, well, the musicians love it.
Mm-hmm.
They understand what's going on. How come?
Mm-hmm.
How would you invite someone into it? How would you cushion the surround so that they can step out of their everyday sort of 90s economic values laden environment and walk into your environment?
I don't know. You know, in the arts, there's no right and wrong, and you never appeal to everybody. And some people will like what you do, and others won't. And whether there are 12 people who like what you do or 40 million is kind of mysterious.
So you need a good publicist.
There you go. I'm not sure. I guess maybe, yeah, it would probably help. I don't know. I've seen publicists work very hard on things, and it doesn't seem to make any difference either. It's mysterious. I mean, the thing is, people are bombarded with this multimedia corporate barrage of... I mean, it's such a money-making thing in the arts. Huge companies that are not interested in moderate sales. They're only interested in superstars and blockbuster sales. It's actually sick. I mean, the situation is sick now, and it's true of music, it's true of publishing, and it's true of movies, American movies in general. Of course, there are exceptions, but it's very hard to find a book publisher who can take on a book that's only going to sell 12,000 copies, even though they might make a moderate profit on 12,000 copies, because the huge companies are only interested in enormous profits.
As are we, but this is something that has completely befuddled us. We have not been subject to enormous profits or virtually any profits.
Well, you say as are we, but I don't think that's true. I mean, of course, we'd be delighted if somebody showered us with millions of dollars in profits, but that's not what motivates us. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting around this table.
That's correct, but I hold out hope.
Well, that's good to hold out hope. But, hold out hope. Yeah, sure, hold out hope. I hold out hope, too. One hopes that there'll be the bad situation will get better.
Yes.
It used to be, I worked as a record producer in the 60s at Columbia Records when the head of Columbia Records was Goddard Lieberson,
yes,
the composer. And he cared about music rather than profits.
Yes.
He did a lot of things that just made moderate profit or no profit. And toward the end of that time, when I was working there, the first computer printouts of sales started coming out.
Uh-huh.
And around 1969, the sales manager started walking around with these computer printouts, and that was the beginning of the end. It started getting much more efficient, and the phrase dollar return per cubic foot started being used.
Ooh. And this is your fault.
Well, I was.
Started using
I was there,
computers.
But
yeah.
But I think I was using. I think I had something else in mind. It's funny because there was a time when the technology seemed to be offering a utopian solution. Marshall McLuhan.
Yes.
And Cage was influenced
yes.
by that too. That turned out not to be true.
Why not? I mean,
because human nature follows the technology. Whatever characteristics there are in the human character get carried over into the technology.
Hmm.
So
hmm.
there's evil as well as good.
How well we know.
How well we know.
We embrace it if it can give us a profit, but perhaps not entirely.
Yeah, just some of that evil stuff. Well, interactivity. You talked about that a couple of times. And we are seeing a high level of interactivity now with digital stuff, everything from games and internet stuff, through even interactive drama, where
mm-hmm.
you choose the process it goes through. This doesn't seem like the direction you were looking for.
Well, it is. It's just that everything has become interactive so that you almost don't have to use that word anymore.
All right.
Because it was an exciting new word back in 77.
Uh-huh.
And I like to avoid it now because everybody uses it all the time.
Do you think your work has been co-opted?
Well, no. I wouldn't say that. I just think that now, since everything is interactive, you can pick and choose to see what sort of interactive things you are interested in. I'm doing one kind, and other people are doing another kind. I mean, sure, we were ahead of our time in a way, those of us like Laurie Spiegel and others who were working. I mean, there was a time when there were only a dozen people working in interactive music, and now it's not even worth using the word anymore.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it's been co-opted. It's like there was a time when no one used a printing press, and then everyone had access to the printing press, and then there's still the question of which books are better than others, or more interesting, or whatever.
So where are you taking your work now?
I'm trying to work with voices. I'm trying to work with several people at once. For a long time, it was mostly one person. One person, and then it was sometimes two, and now I'm trying to work with more and sometimes with voices. The last piece I did was had two vocalists and two instrumentalists, and the voices were interactive with text. And that was something I just started a couple of years ago. And I've done one piece that uses that technique, which we could play a little of. The thing I might play for you, is there still time to play?
Absolutely, yeah.
It's a text by Siegfried Sassoon, who, do either of you know that name? Do you know the name Wilfred Owen, you might know?
Yes.
Yeah, he and Sassoon were both poets in World War I, who wrote poetry in the battle trenches of World War I. Wilfred Owen is better known because he, Benjamin Britten,
yes,
used his text. But Sassoon was also a wonderful poet. And I made a piece that has texts by Sassoon and by my father, who was a writer and who became a friend of Sassoon back in 1920. And I made a piece last year that I'd been working on it for a couple of years, that was commissioned by Thomas Buckner.
Yes, we played something of Buckner on the Tom Hamilton, as a matter of fact, I believe, was Tom Buckner singing in that recording
right.
we had.
Yeah, right. And it was because of Thomas, that I worked on this piece. I mean, I'd been wanting to do it anyway, but I did it. And we've performed it twice. And so in this case, in the piece that I could play, the interaction is not based on pitches, but it's just on changes of dynamic. Because the voice, it's a different feeling with a voice. It's not really, again, the vocalist is not told what to do, but he has a text. And so whatever he decides to do with the text, there's an interaction of changes of dynamic of his voice. It doesn't matter what pitch he sings, or whether he sings or speaks or chants or something between speaking and singing. Anyway, he plays in this situation. He works with the situation. And in this piece, there's also interactive inputs for the two instrumentalists, one of which is Ralph Samuelson playing shakuhachi, mm-hmm. and Peter Zumo playing trombones and other wind instruments. So the three of them have interaction, all based on changes of dynamics rather than hitting specific pitches. And then the computer does things on its own also, which sets up a kind of a modal feeling in this case.
Mm-hmm. How, in what context do the performers understand what they're to do? How much instruction do you give them? And let me just sort of cushion that in this question. How much of it depends on a kind of a vocabulary that is yours or part of a specific subset of the musical culture?
Yeah, I think a vocabulary develops as you work on the piece. But sometimes a performer can break out of the vocabulary and do something that seems strange, and sometimes that's very nice. I mean, so I think what I've learned about the way of working is the environment that the synthesizers and the software offer suggests a way of performing. But different performers might get different ideas of what to do. And if they're very good musicians, then whatever they decide is all right with me.
Okay, all right.
Something like that.
Yeah. Let's hear some of it. The name of it is?
This is called, the name of the piece,
yes.
It's about letters between Sassoon and my father.
All right.
And it's called My Dear Siegfried.
Great. Here's an excerpt from My Dear Siegfried by David Berman.
Far off, in earliest remembered childhood, I can overhear myself repeating the words, watercress well. I am kneeling by an old stone wellhead. My mother is standing beside me, and we are looking into the water. My mother tells me that it is a very deep rising spring, but I do not want to be told anything about it, even by her. I want nothing at all, except to be gazing at the water which bubbles so wonderfully up out of the earth, and dip my fingers in it, and scatter the glittering drops. From its wellhead, the spring overflows into cresty shallows. Thence it wanders away as a gurgling and purposeful runnel, which may someday, for all I can tell, arrive at being a real Kentish river. The well reflects the empty sky. I can see myself there, rather soon, when I am not watching the bubbles climbing up in the middle of the crystal clear water. From that so intensely remembered source, all my journeys now seem to have started. If I were to go back and look for it, I might find that it has vanished. But in my thoughts, it is forever the same. Around and above it whisper the woodland branches. Time's wavering shadows are falling across the glade. But there will be no sunset for that pictured afternoon. Light as a leaf, a robin drops down and decides to have a drink. I look again. The robin is not there. Out of sight. For we are halfway across a breezy meadow, leaving behind us watercress well and the rivulet that goes running through the wood, talking to itself in the wordless language of water, roots, and stone.
My dear Siegfried, music by David Behrman, and improvisational, responsive, interactive, to use the word that now everybody has expropriated for their own interests. One of our other friends in the compositional world, Joel Chatterby, has suggested that there's a thing we should ask everyone, and I thought it was absolutely wonderful. Mm. He said, why don't you ask people what they believe their pioneering act was.
What their pioneering act was.
Pioneering act, yeah.
I've gotten to the age where I'm sometimes referred to as a pioneer. And I always think, well, that's sort of, that means I'm over the hill.
So. Even in 1972, we were referring to you as the pioneer with a
you were?
Uppercase P.
You were? Like,
we were?
Really? Really?
The pioneer.
Really?
We wanted you to take that Mormon Tabernacle Choir and mold it to your own will. Have them just ululate beyond belief. We really believed you could do it, and it hasn't happened yet. We're still hoping.
Interactive Mormon Tabernacle ululation.
I used to edit them, their Christmas carols in July, which was very strange. In the heat waves in New York, I used to edit the Mormon Tabernacle Choir doing Christmas carols.
And you never had the...
But I never got my hands on it with my own devices.
Notice he's avoided the pioneering act question
entirely.
But I think
what's the pioneering act? I like to think, I mean, everyone hopes, like, we hope we're still alive, right? We hope we can still get some new ideas. And so maybe there, I mean, hopefully there's more than one pioneering act, if there are any at all. I mean, maybe there'll be one tomorrow.
Good. Thanks very much, David Behrman, for being our guest on the Kalmus and Damien New Music Bazaar.
It's really, truly bizarre to be doing this, especially since we have these connections that go back.
Variously.
Yeah, variously.
Maybe I can dig up that old recording. You know, I recorded that 1977, so I probably have that somewhere.
That's amazing.
So I'll go see if I can dig up that tape. David Behrman, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Music by David Behrman, that from Refractive Light, that was the last section, Ein Gläserle Warms.
Evocative.
Evocative.
No compromises.
Indeed. We got a phone call asking if, in fact, all his music had this spirit to it. And you were, you knew him, and maybe you could speak to that. You worked with him in Ohio.
Yeah, those were the Colgate Palmolive days when he was making a lot of tracks for advertisements, mouth products, as I recall. You may recall many of the themes. They
yes.
go through the... Oh, no, that wasn't David Behrman. That was Fritz Behrman. Sorry, I do get the two confused.
Fritz Kreisler.
That
no,
too?
That was Detroit.
Oh.
Never mind. So much for asking you a serious question here on the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield.
Yep, it was intended as a serious response. I just had them confused, as I normally do. Are we ready to have more from Austria?
No, apparently we have been disconnected from Austria. So we will go on to non-compromising music.
Yeah, what defines non-compromising music?
I don't know. Do you dare ask me that question? Let's say that Behrman certainly does, because he has maintained this thread of uncompromising serenity, if that you can use that kind of a almost conflict of words.
Yeah, it did make me nervous. In fact, his idea of serenity does not necessarily jive with mine. But still, I agree. I think he is steadfast, resolute in his style of composition, as is the next composer we are about to hear, Nick Didkowski, at least in this particular...
Nick Collins.
All the Nicks are sometimes resolute in their compositions, and this one is performed by the Soldier String Quartet, and we've played it before, but not in the sense of a non-compromised tune. This is Broken Light by Nick Didkowski.
Collins.
The first movement, Corelli, from Broken Light by Nick Didkovsky Corelli Collins, performed for string quartet and hot-wired CD player. The string quartet was a Soldier string quartet, and the hot-wired CD was a Wallensack. And more of music from space. Well, short-lived music from space.
Connected back to Austria for the radio festival on the internet.
Time for another Nick.
We're still struggling to keep the old connection to Austria, so time for another Nick,
I think. This is not the previous Nick, but a different Nick, the Didkovsky of Dr. Nerve fame. This is his Nerveware number 8, performed by New Ear.
Another Scott?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, great.
No compromises.
No compromises.
Not from Nick, Dr. Merrick.
We're connected with Austria again. Oh, and disconnected with Nick Didkovsky. What an interesting character, and such a young fella.
Yeah, just starting out.
Nick Didkovsky, Dr. Nerve, and from the Every Screaming Ear CD, Nerveware number 8.
Okay, no compromises there. He has his own set of rules, and he sticks with them.
He does indeed. Oh. Hello, Austria, calling Austria.
Sounds not unlike a Kelvinator. More of this.
Allison Cameron.
Well, she... she's pretty uncompromising.
Yeah, she is, actually. We played one piece, The Blank Sheet of Metal, in which the pauses got longer and longer and longer, and there were these loud, powerful chords at one point separated by 45 seconds of silence. So, that's...
Now,
thank you, Austria. Let's move on to Alison Cameron and the opening of Ross Angudo, a very fresh-sounding piece from 10 years ago. Ross Angudo, Alison Cameron.
No prisoners, no compromise.
Right. Very different from the one we're going to hear now, which is music by Zbigniew Karkowski. Let's see if Austria's here yet. Zbigniew Karkowski said that, in one of his most famous quotes, that more people heard his music in his lifetime, and he wasn't even 30 yet, than Mozart in all of his lifetime.
Gosh, that's
So the very numbers, it puts it in perspective. Hello, Austria.
Yeah, all right.
All right, there they are. We had a little Austria. Well, let's listen to some Zbigniew Tarkovsky. This is when he was with a group called Hafler Trio. He's now performing with a in Japan with the artist Merzbo. And we have dibs in for a CD of that's just about to be released of Zbigniew Tarkovsky and Merzbo, released in Japan. So we'll hope to have that soon. In the meantime, here's Tarkovsky and crowd Hafler Trio from a Ash CD. And I think this piece is untitled. An untitled piece by them. Just the opening. No compromises here either. Mozart, where are you now, huh?
But you can dance to it, which is something that so many people were unable to do to Mozart's music.
True, true. You just can't dance to those Viennese country dances.
Exactly right.
Well, we have another lack of compromiser guy here coming up.
Oh, Mr. Zappa. Yeah, he no compromised himself right into an early
retirement from life.
That's true. Yeah. Alas, he respires no more. Lassie doesn't. Oh, we're back to Austria.
Austria's still here. A little of it anyway. And you have what there?
Envelopes. Nice old piece, 1978, not so old, from Frank Zappa, where he was not compromising, performed by the Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music Wind.
Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music
Wind Symphony.
Symphony playing Zappa?
That's right.
All right, let's hear it.
Who could do it better than Cincy? We'll wait for a break. Thank you. Envelopes by Frank Zappa, funded in part by a major grant from Hallmark cards and envelopes.
And envelopes. My goodness, that was an interesting little bit there. So sweetly played by the Cincinnati Wind Symphony.
And people are always knocking, but not these folks in Austria.
And there they are again. And gone again. Well, that was our attempt at participating in the worldwide conjunction of radio stations that are rebroadcasting the Austrian radio celebration of 25 years of radio art.
All you have to do, though, folks, listeners, is tune in to www.maltedmedia.com and you will be linked directly to this very radio broadcast.
Oh, we wish. Matter of fact, I think I'll do that.
See?
I'll run right home and do it. And, well, goodbye, Austria. Good night.
Hard to turn it off, isn't it? There's so much that is saying.
There is so much being said. But instead, we'll turn to finish up the Calvos and Damian show today with Retunings, a totally uncompromised piece. No droning, no drum machines, no New Age crap, as what's-his-name Laurenti said.
But isn't that an old acoustic instrument?
The viola?
So that's a bit of a compromise. Yeah. Anything with a viola is a compromise.
Anything with a compromise is a viola.
That's it.
That's the Calvos and Damian show for today. Ann Southam, Retunings, played by Rivka Galani. Next week, we begin the marathon interview with Laurie Spiegel.
What a treat.
A production of Baltic Media.